Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, and I hope that you had a great July 4th weekend, and now that we're plowing into the heat of summer, we're back and we're live, and for those getting the podcast, we're popping back up into your feed again, and this is a great opportunity to come out of the heat, and I think, unfortunately, my illustrious co-host had escaped to higher elevations, but now he's down in the fever-swamped lowlands. But it's been a couple of weeks. Eagle One, great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks. It was I was at altitude, but it wasn't any cooler. It was really hot. And we came down here, and I thought, well, it's actually cooler down here than it was up there. But it's still hot and miserable. So, you know, it's summertime.
Yeah, that's the price we pay for not living in Maine. No offense, Claude. Yeah, it's just too damn cold up there. But that's okay. But like all good Southerners are, before air conditioning, and we keep our traditions, you want to kind of find low-impact activities just so you don't die of heat stroke. I made the mistake last week of not following that advice. But and in the pre-show, just for the listeners to know, we're gonna take a little side trip here. My co-host brought up the topic that one of the best ways, whether you got HVAC or not, to avoid the heat is to find a good book. And over the course of years, we've interviewed a lot of authors here, both fiction, nonfiction, most of them involving the military or the career of arms, so to speak. And I think that's a great topic. So we have all the news of the day that we could chat about on the other end, but we're going to catch up from some of the things we have started on the pre-show. And I immediately went to some of my recent acquisitions that I haven't got my 40-hour day to be able to read. But my co-host brought up the fact that, you know, it's not just, you know, history and nonfiction, but there's also some great fiction out there. So whether you're a listener or not, so I figured we'd just kick off the show for 1 minute or 60 minutes, and let's just talk about some books, some of the things that we're thinking about, or some of the things that we've gotten, and how we're going to kind of grab some books to avoid the heat. You know, Mark, you mentioned some great ideas of some book recommendations, but also kind of a philosophical bent that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I don't remember the philosophical bent, but, you know, learning about how people think and why they make the decisions they do, I think is really important. So a lot of the books that I like are written by guys who are former COs, and many of the books of either squadrons or ships, and many of the books are fiction. Some of them are based on real life events, and they've substituted characters in from real life. So, you know, when I'm reading or listening to some books by a retired Navy captain named P.T. Duderman, who is a former CO of a destroyer, but he's more my vintage, so the destroyers were not, that he commanded were not, or served on, were not the modern miracle of electronic innovation that the current ones are. But, you know, he's got a situation where a destroyer CO's in the battles of the Solomons in the slot, and the guy's got to decide, where should I be fighting this ship? And, you know, the doctrine in those days was the CO is always on the bridge and you can run the battle from there. But with the advent of radar, he realizes that day is going to die, that he can't get the picture that he could if he was in combat information center. And so, you know, as you see this change nowadays, the commanders of ships are they're supposed to be in combat. They're supposed to be where they can see the big screens and see the big picture and hear from the sonar people. But think what an innovation that simple amount of technology, what we today think is simple radar and sonar, had on the way the approach to battle was made. So the attacks of World War II, if you read about the battles in the slot against the Japanese and the effects of the long lance torpedoes, and when the radar caught on, and the people who were smart enough got the idea of how to use it to our advantage, and really turned the course of the war against the Japanese Navy and that type of night action, and helped us move the battle forward. So if you start thinking about fiction and you see what this character is going through, and Lord knows I was on an old destroyer, my CO had to go through that decision and ended up looking at and actually went into CIC, leaving the officer of the deck to make sure we weren't going to run into anything. But you know, that was a big decision for these officers who have to balance what the doctrine says with what the reality is of the situation. So I think that's important to see how a simple thing like that can change the way we view the world. And I think fiction is a great way to put that forward.
That's exactly the philosophy I was looking for. And just the, there's a couple of authors, just to give everybody a preview, that, sometime this summer, it really depends upon their publisher and when they begin the big push. We have a reporter, John Dunleavy, has a book coming out. I'll remember the title here in a little bit. And a prior guest, Seth Folsom, he just recently left active duty last year. We've had him on before. Nothing Here Worth Dying For, the story of Task Force Lion that went after ISIS in northern Iraq and rolled that up. Just a great piece of nonfiction. And I think that's the key, is not only if you're trying to understand what is happening today, but to try to get a handle on what options we may come in the future, whether as an individual or a nation, studying the past or fiction based upon the past, or even the recent future, it's great because it makes you think. I remember the young junior officer, I asked people, what should I read? And I was told biographies. I forget the exact phrase. I had one of my professors mentioned to me, he said, don't go for autobiographies. He had a clever turn of phrase about autobiographies. But he said, biographies are good if you want to learn how people think, and also get, especially if you can read more than one on somebody you really find interesting, is a good biographer won't just give you the fuzzy view of the individual, but the complicated view of the individual, where even great people and great leaders may have faults or may have weaknesses, but that doesn't detract from their greatness, which I think is helpful if you're working with or for somebody who isn't perfect, that you accept that and you look for the larger plus or minus of an individual and the role that they play. I think it's also very interesting to see where leaders or just plain old individuals are faced in a situation where they have no great answers or they have no great options, but they have to pick one. And how you have to live with that. Because I think we've all seen in our lives people, and regardless of whether you're a military officer or a mailman or something in between, that often you have to make a decision at the moment. Or you make a decision in error, or you're just a human being and thinking that you're the only person that's ever come into that situation can wear a lot on a person's soul and can wear their feelings of themselves a little thin and can paralyze them. But if you read a lot and you're able to get a little better perspective on even, great men and women and some of their mistakes, shortcomings, or how they came around them, it can really help you in your everyday life. And especially if you're a leader and you've got people that you're responsible for, when you make yourself better and you have a little more confidence, a little more forgiving of yourself, those people rely on the decisions you make. So it's better for everybody down the chain. And yeah, we talk about books a lot, and it's really easy to get caught up in the immediate dopamine hit of social media and stuff. But yeah, when it's 98 degrees outside with 90% humidity, and you've got a chair that's right under a vent, and you have a little book next to you, it's a great way to not create much internal heat, but to really build up in your mind some great perspective. And in a way, it could be therapeutic.
Yeah, I think the ability to place yourself in the position of somebody who's got to confront one of those decisions. And I think if you read the Patrick O'Brien novels, the Audrey Matrin books, the Dewey Landon books, the Alan Lurie series, Claude's, Barraby's, Connor Stark books, these are people who are constantly in situations where they have to think of a solution to a problem that exists. And of course, with the age of sail, you had a little more time to deal with it. The nice thing about reading some of the more contemporary fiction, the Caine Mutiny, Herman Wouk books, War and Remembrance, there are a lot of books, fictional or not, about how we fought World War II, but not always necessarily in the psychology of what goes on when you're under fire and your ship is headed into a dangerous situation. How do you address that? And it's really good to get that and to practice in your own mind. And this is what we were taught as JOs was, if you're out here on watch and it's boring, and a lot of times being on watch is boring, think of situations where, what if this happened? What would you do if, those what if situations are what makes for great fiction, and the solutions and the creative ways people come up to solve the problem should be the focus of, I think, a lot of shipboard conversations or squadron conversations about, and I don't, since I was never a naval aviator myself, I've got a couple of close ones to me, but is that discussed in the ready room? Here's the situation, how would you deal with this? I mean, I think that's part of the training. I think that's part of what Top Gun is supposed to help you do, send aviators back to teach other people how to think through those situations. But the wardroom discussion of tactics and all that, that's really where the training goes. We have all these war colleges and academies and stuff, but the essential part ought to be out there. And I think our friend just was reading his book, and I ought to remember this. It'll come to me. Another rotorhead who has a book called The Naval Mind, Growing the Naval Mind, Improving the Naval Mind. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, I can't pull it off my head.
Yeah, hang on. I've got it here somewhere. We'll make everybody wait for my brain to work.
Well, while you're picking that up, I just remember Jerry Dunleavy and James Hansen's book that's coming out pretty soon. It's what a lot of us have been waiting for, and we've talked about here. It's Kabul, the Untold Story of Biden's Fiasco and the American Warriors Who Fought to the End. Maybe we'll talk later on. I had on my list of things maybe to talk about was the Department of State's data dump right before July 4th weekend. But yeah, I think Jerry and James' book, coming out when it is, a couple years after September and August of 2021, I think it's going to be first in a whole series of books that are going to be looking at that story, which I think we would have seen more about it if the Russo-Ukrainian war didn't kick off.
Yeah, I think that's the other context is a lot of times things don't make any sense unless you have the historical background to know. Thank you, Chris. D.G. Armstrong's book, Improving the Naval Mind or whatever it is it's a really good way to talk, think about. He has suggestions and items in there for people to take to their ready rooms and their wardrooms, and let's talk about this article. And some of them are from proceedings, some of them are from other places. That's a great idea, and I wish more ships that I served on had done that. And in fact, I regret that I didn't do more of that when I was a CO of some units that could have used some training like that. But that's the kind of thing. And you know, all the books, I've got all these books here, the China's Law of the Sea, the Freedom's Forge, you know, they're all background into how difficult it is to get a country ready to go to war, and what we're dealing with when somebody wants to impose their will on a world that isn't quite ready for it. And I, in a lot of these books, I pick up because we've talked to people on the show. So somebody mentioned John Lehman's book, Oceans Ventured, and that's available on Kindle. So now I've got that on my list here. I got too much stuff to read here, but you know, and then that led me somewhere else to the Korean Air War, and I go, well, you know, that's probably a pretty important thing because we did fight a war there. I'd probably know more about that. So we have, you know, there. It, one thing leads to another. You end up doing a lot of reading. Some of it is germane directly to what you're talking about, and some of it is thinking about, and some of it is maybe not as directly related, but it's sort of like if you read, and this is going to go off in the Navy Con, and when we had David Weber at the Navy Con a few years ago, you know, I'm reading his books, and I'm going, well, he took this directly from the American. So he's got the Safehold series, and the Safehold series has this planet way off out in nowhere where the people have gone to hide. But the book is based on the transition from it's Mahan. It is Mahan in a science fiction scheme of things. It's really wonderfully well done. And then we've discussed before his concept of these spaceships with what I've called in my blog and stuff, missile barges, you know. I mean, it's a concept that ought to work. Anyway, you can't go wrong by reading this. You can read Heinlein's, some of Heinlein's books that involve the, you know, I mean, everybody recommends Starship Troopers, but there are other ones out there that are designed to help you think about how things ought to work. And, you know, all that led to, well, if you're going to read books this summer, and I see everybody's giving us great lists here in the chat room, you know, then what about movies that are fun? I mean, just good, solid movies to watch. And I thought, well, okay, let's put down a list. What have I watched so far this summer? Well, I watched, In Harm's Way. They were Expendable. Away All Boats, Greyhound, The Bridges of Toko Rhea. I mean, The Bridges of Toko Rhea is a great film and a great book. Destination Tokyo. What was that? I don't remember. I can't read my own writing anymore. You know, Top Gun, whatever the second movie is. And then I was looking at it going, oh, you know, what that great funny movie, Hot Shots. That's kind of a fun. That's a fun one. So, you know, they're just. I think we have all kinds of stuff that you can do in the summer to get yourself out of the heat and have a good time. Not to mention books. Here's another one. Stephen Kuntz, before he went completely loony about flying saucers, you know, isn't he the guy who wrote Flight of the Intruder and all that? So, you know, and there's always the Sand Pebbles, you know, and there are any number of books on the China fleet era. We've mentioned them on the show before. But, you know, if you're dealing with China, part of what you have to understand is getting the background. There's some good books on the Opium Wars and the effect that had on China. And I think those are, you know, good background to understand what excuse they use to be the way they are and what, you know, how they've their revenge against the culture that took away their great empire.
You know, one thing that, and I try and I have, Seth's Folsom books I've read on my iPad, and I do read a fair number, mostly because I get them from the library for free. But, you know, that's one thing that, you know, getting books can get expensive real fast. And I would offer anybody on the line, I'm making assumptions here, but if you don't have a library card, you should get one for your local library. Also, MWR, you can get books through them too as well. But you would be surprised, if you're a listener to Midrats, you think a certain way, the amount of good books that you can get on audiobook are also your Kindle ebooks from the library. You just have to read them in a timely manner before the electrons suck it away, depending upon which library you use. But that's another way that you can get those books that cost you nothing but the effort of getting a library card. And another thing, if you're in a lot of people in the Navy, either through NAS Jacksonville or at Mayport, are familiar with, and most, I know there's, I can't remember it in Norfolk what it's called, but pretty much any town has secondhand bookstores that are pretty extensive. In Northeast Florida, it's Shamblin's Book Mine. And, you know, when we decided that we were going to talk about books, I was, you know, I felt like a kid at Christmas again. I was like, oh, I got to show everybody my presents. But you can go over there and you can get, you know, if you know, what are we going to do in the future? Everything kind of cycles and repeats. There are some great minds. And for instance, there's a whole series of these, but I just picked up this one. And I think what I'll do is on the show page, I'll put up links so people on the podcast, and maybe if I have enough room on Spreaker's text, I'll put a link to as many of the things that we talk about here for folks to look at. But John Hopkins University Press in 1974, and I can't pronounce his name correctly, Edward Lutwak, Luttwak. You can Google him. He's a pretty big head. It's a little thin little book that next time I'm at a secondhand bookstore, I want to see what the other ones, but they had Studies in International Affairs number 23 was the political uses of sea power. It's a rip-roaring 74-page hardcover. That I'm going to take care of next time the rain interferes with my ability to mow the yard. But and I think I mentioned this once. I don't know if it was a Midrats or online or something. But there was a series of books that was put out at the opening of World War II. And I had the copy from 1941 by some guy who I really don't recognize with the last name of Baldwin. But What the Citizens Should Know About the Navy. And as I've done the usual, I just want to read a page from the middle. This has all sorts of stuff that it's a shame we don't have some modern way of doing this. But I guess in some ways, you know, that's what we do on Midrats and what they do at SimSec and War on the Rocks and other locations online where people are talking about trying to enhance awareness. Really neat book. And I want to credit either Sal Marcogliano or John Conrad, one of the two, but they mention this book by retired Rear Admiral Henry Eccles. And this imprint is from, 1959. It's a first edition. But this is Logistics in the National Defense. And I'll tell you, it's there's not much that changes about sticking stuff in a hull and getting it west and hoping that your supply income incoming is greater than your expenditures outgoing. And this is one of the things I think when I get through reading, I'm going to beat my head against the wall for about 20 minutes. And when you're talking about the bridges of Tokari, this, I forgot, it may have, Alessio may have recommended this to me a while ago, but it was right up there on the shelf and I had to get it. And it's from 1942, Random House, Suez to Singapore by, it's a Cecil Brown's story, quote, grim warfare in the desert and the Malay jungles, the sinking of Repulse and Prince of Wales, the fall of Singapore's and the last day of the Indias into Australia today. So the war, at least for the Commonwealth, was only halfway done. And he had already pushed out this book that's got some great, great maps. And it's almost 600 pages long. And a lot of these used bookstores, some of them will have a military section. Other ones will have a history section. Some of them will have a military history section. It's kind of like sifting for gold. But I got a whole stack of stuff that I've picked up over the course of the last few years, bouncing into these places. It's now closed, but back in the 1990s, there was a hole-in-the-wall used bookstore in St. Augustine. I was there for a romantic weekend with my wife. Yeah, ladies, you're lucky you didn't marry me. On this romantic weekend, I found an English translation of Mussolini's treaties from the 1920s, which I don't think many were made, but I have a copy of Mussolini's, what was it titled, The Impact of Fascism on History from the 1920s. So it was a romantic weekend for me. But you can find them almost anywhere, and especially in historical towns, whether you find yourself in, I don't know, Bath, Maine, or up there in Monterey, any town that's been there for a while, I'm sure in San Diego, because a lot of people in these estate sales, they'll clear out the libraries, and you have a lot of retired, I know in D.C. there are some as well, but they're picked clean pretty fast. You have these retired people who their kids or their heirs or whoever, they don't care about the library. And so they'll get rid of their books by the pound. And there are some really incredible opportunities there, but you've got to go to the used bookstore and pick through them. But that's kind of fun anyway, the smell of the used bookstore. I don't know what the smell is, but I don't have allergies, so it doesn't bother me. But that's a great way to lose half an afternoon to get books that can take up weeks of your time in a good way.
Yeah, and I would recommend that the Naval Institute has a 13-book series called Studies in Naval History and Sea Power. And, you know, I've got three of these books I'm currently reading. But, you know, the titles are A Ceaseless Watch, Australia's Third-Party Naval Defense, Admiral John S. McCain and the Triumph of Naval Air Power, Churchill's Phony War, Studies in Folly, A Study in Folly and Frustration, Cossack, which is the story the man who actually managed the organization of Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion, Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Morgan. And then there's the emergence of American amphibious warfare, rise and fall of French sea power, genesis of the Grand Fleet, the Admiralty Germany Home Fleet, Learning War, Evolution of the Fighting Doctrine in the Navy, 1898-1945. I mean, we were just talking about how important it is to remember we are learning. The Navy is a learning organization. And, you know, if you get stuck as behind tradition, then you have to wait for somebody like to come along and turn a blind eye to people who are being dumb. So that's not always, work in their benefit, but it helps everybody else. Anyway, Mahan, Corbett, there's a whole list in the USNI webpage. I highly recommend you take a look at that. It includes, books by U-boat commanders, Victory Without Peace, the U.S. and the European waters in 1919-1924, and then a little study of warships. So if most of these, as Sal said, many of these are available on the DoD library system, which you can go through nowadays through Libby. And sometimes your local library can get interlibrary loans from your nearby colleges and universities, and a lot of these books are available there. But gosh, I've got sitting here, hard copies of The Abandoned Ocean, which is about the decline of the U.S. maritime world, Operation Insweep, which is about the demining operation after Vietnam, China and Russia, their great game thing. Somebody sent us years ago to, I was supposed to review it, I guess, at some point, Hell from the Heavens about the USS Laffey, Unsung Heroes, once again about the Merchant Mariners. That's a U.S. Naval Institute book, by the way. And then I just bought Falwell's Rules of the Nautical Road because I'm a little rusty on some of that stuff. So
everybody will know when it comes out. It might not get published. If not, I'm going to ask him if I can publish it. But a friend of the show who remained nameless has submitted an article for publication. You talk about Rules of the Road. And when I first saw it, I was pissed off. Why was I pissed off? Because I didn't think of it. I was like, come on. But as far as I know, nobody else has written about it. But And I've made some snarky comments because that's just kind of my role in the ecosystem. Comma, however, irrespective of my snarky comments, he identified a gap in the rules of the road, and, you know, red over red, captain is dead. Everybody has their lights and their day shapes and what those mean. You know, do we really have what we need in the era of, let me use the term of the day, uncrewed surface vessels that can really advertise the fact, because it's some of these things are obviously they don't have any people on them, but when you're talking the really large ones, and if a couple of the theories play out over the course of the next few decades, there's going to be more and more of them going from point A to point B that are uncrewed. You know, how do you identify to somebody who might be coming up on channel 16 and trying to talk to that 325-foot merchant vessel next to them that they're not sure whether there's anybody on board or not? How do you have signals like that? But yeah, the rules of the road, I think, is something everybody could brush up on, especially if you were on the water over July 4th weekend like I was. It was crazy. I don't think I'm ever going on the water another major holiday again. Makes me itchy. But I also liked the observation that you made a little bit earlier, because it came back in my mind about the missile barges and a lot of the stuff in series of fiction books that you, when you read it, you go, hey, this is Mahan, or hey, this is Corbett. They're just putting, you know, it's Mahan in space or whatever. But by reading these books, one thing that it really gets ingrained into you is, and one of the things that really was ingrained in me at an early age, and the more I read, the more I go, yep, there's another example. Yep, there's another example. It's not that there is anything new under the sun. There is. There's some great things. There's some really exciting things. But generally speaking, no. First of all, people are the same. People's motivations are the same. They may vary from culture to culture, and the clothes they wear might be slightly different. Their longevity might be different. But people are people, human weaknesses, you know, fallen, whatever. Those patterns repeat themselves, but also geography doesn't change, and intake and exhaust doesn't change, and how you can respond to unexpected circumstances or to hedge against the unexpected. Other people have done it and have done it really, really, really well. And whether you're reading the fiction, you can point it out. But when you start reading up in the past, when you have a pretty important, whether it's a politician or a think tank person or somebody in Congress or an influential writer or speaker or educator, when they're talking about something that is just breaking news or is happening today or, you know, it has just recently come up, it gives you a chance to hear things that have already been spoken before and challenges people have already experienced. And it really, I think, empowers the listener as other people start to come up with their original ideas. And I just realized my co-host has to step out for a minute. And for those that are with us live, if you're not in the chat room, I'd go there, because as we've been talking about certain books here over in the chat room, guys are really starting to roll in with some other items. I started writing down early on some of the books that we had were talking about, so I could add it to the show page. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to do that, because we have really talked a lot about it. Someday I think we might have to do a discussion about other podcasts that are out there as well, but I think in the summertime, there's something about a book, especially if you have one in your hand, that can really be a different experience than either listening to something, whether it's a book or it's a podcast or something else. And the hard copies are the better, I think, If for no other reasons, you can pack it and move it. I flew out to the West Coast a while ago, and I'll be flying out there again in a couple of months. Well, the mountains, not quite the West Coast. And it's funny, I had a book that, matter of fact, I still have another chapter to go, me reading three books at one time, that was written in the 1920s about the war in Ukraine between the Russian whites, the Germans, the Reds, the indigenous, for lack of a better phrase, Ukrainian forces, and the back and forth. It's all the interplay is, and the locations are just what we're looking at today. But I'm reading that book, and as everybody else is up on the phone scrolling, I caught the eye of a gentleman probably in his mid-30s who's reading a book too. We just kind of gave each other a little head nod about, oh, you're reading a book too. We were like the only people who actually had books. So that was a nice little retro thing. But I also do like to read on that iPad. And I guess, I'm not sure when my co-host will come back, but I've talked about all the books that I wanted to talk in, and we don't have a caller. So let's just go ahead. I mentioned, oh, you're back. I was just about to go into the news of the day. So
go into the news of the day. I'm sorry, I had to leave my my neighbor did me a big favor over the weekend, and I wanted to give him a bottle of wine before he left where he's going. So
that's a good neighbor.
My apologies to everybody.
No, I was just mentioning to him that one of the fun things about a book is when I was traveling to the West Coast last, I was sitting there. Everybody's on their phone or on their iPads or on their laptop doing work. And I was going through the book. I still have a chapter left to finish. And I caught the eye with another traveler across the way. We kind of did a little head nod to each other because we're the ones reading books when everybody else is electric. So yeah, there's a little bit of a retro thing with a book, too, that you can't get with anything else.
Yeah, I read a lot on the iPad and sometimes on my phone. But, yeah, then I've got these heavy things that weigh me down.
Yeah, I also subscribe to too many magazines, so when I travel, I get the 2 months worth of magazines I haven't read. And but my pack gets lighter as the day goes forward because I read, throw it in recycling, read, throw it in recycling. But yeah, I kind of mentioned it before. And I think I've been talking to Dunleavy for a while about it, waiting for an opportunity to talk to him about his book that Jerry did with James Hansen about Kabul. Is I think the timing's pretty good because I don't know if you had a chance to look at, if not the document, but at least some of the commentary of the State Department report on the fall of Afghanistan that they accidentally, I'm sure, dumped right on the Friday before the July 4th weekend.
I'm scanning it now, as a matter of fact. So, you'll tell me all about it. What's the executive summary?
Well, the executive summary is, well, if you want to, folks, you can find it. Just Google after action review on Afghanistan, January 2020 to August 2021, and some of the notes that I took while reading it. Let me scroll back here. Everybody can hear my paper being shuffled. Here we go. It's interesting. One of my favorite people, Victoria Coates, after she got through reading it, she had a comment that I think it was pretty spot on. It's the State Department was shifting the blame to the DOD, and basically no one wanted to be left holding the bag. That's what I got reading it from the Department of State. And first of all, I give the State Department credit. The first person to tell the story is going to drive the narrative. And so they got out in front, and they're going to make their excuses, and that's just all fine and dandy. But what I wanted to point everybody to, if you haven't pulled it up, for those that are catching the podcast, I'll definitely have this link on the show page.
I've got the link here. Hang on a second.
If you go to page 11, it's not that long. It's not that long of a document, really.
24 pages.
Yeah. The whole thing is it's kind of making excuses like nobody, we didn't have enough people, we didn't have enough time, you know, my feet hurt. You know, it's all sorts of series, but embedded in that though are some pretty good points. For instance, points 1, 7, 9, and 28. And I've got to move my microphone a little bit to make this happen. But if you look at point 1, it's the decision of President Trump and President Biden to end the military mission in Afghanistan had serious consequences for the viability of Afghan government and their security. The decisions are beyond the scope of this review, but the AAR found items from both administrations that were insufficient senior-level consideration of worst-case scenarios and how quickly those might follow. That is, I think, fair, because I think we've talked here over the course of the last 2 years. One thing that, for lack of a professional phrase to describe it, I call the multi-layered optimism filter, is you could see that of all the different courses of action that were briefed up the chain. And I know everybody wants to dump this in the lap of one person. Ultimately, the commander-in-chief is responsible, but, you know, in a busy world, a leader is really only good as his staff. But you could see where this was just not necessarily the worst-case scenario, but the most likely scenario kept getting through an optimism filter. Make it more optimistic. Take out these problems. Take out the issues. So that amazing couple of clips from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff going, nobody told me, I didn't know. I don't buy it. A lot of people were warning of it. It just never briefed up. Then you had items 7 and 9. Department placed Embassy Kabul on ordered departure status at the end of April in the wake of President Biden's decision, but that did not result in a notable immediate reduction of the embassy's footprint, most of which involves security and life support, in part because of the need to take additional roles and responsibilities given the withdrawal of the U.S. military. Trying to roll the problem to DOD. And the folks that I've talked to who are actually on the ground, the problem was mostly state. Given their direction and guidance, the military did what they could do, given the square footage and the DNG they were given. But everywhere they turned when it was trying to get our people running State Department bureaucracy.
Yeah, you kind of cut out on that last part.
Oh, sorry about that. I must have gotten it. And then there was item number 9 was U.S. military planning for possible NEO, which is non-combatant evacuation operation, had been underway quite some time, but the department participation in NEO planning process was hindered by the fact that it was unclear who in the department had the lead, which department had the lead. Coordination with DOD worked better on the ground in Kabul. That is a long-standing problem with the State Department that I experienced myself working in Afghanistan. It's a whole series of comments. I won't read it, but I think point number 28 I kind of agree with as well. But here's one of the frustratings for me is a lot of it is you're talking about a lack of capacity. And I did a little research, and these are the State Department's own numbers, is the U.S. State Department has an overall number of employees, 77,880. 13,637 are Foreign Service, 11,799 are Civil Service. That gives you a total of Foreign Service and Civil Service of 25,436. They also have 49,973, roughly 50,000 local employees, which I think are, you know, of the host nation, so to speak, employees that they have. So for every one U.S. person, they have two employees that are local. But when you look at the Foreign Service and the Civil Service, that 25,436. When we talk State Department, we think overseas, all the embassies, all the things we do. Only 8,910 are overseas. 16,526 are domestic employees, i.e. mostly inside the Beltway area. And when you consider the amount of blood and treasure that we invested in Afghanistan, and all you had to do was ask anybody who had done any type of tour there, especially at a staff level, what was going to happen. The fact that they were surprised, understaffed, didn't have enough people to do it. If there's not another data point to the need to do a root and branch restructuring the State Department, I don't know what is. And I will grant them the 8,910 that were already overseas. Maybe you could only repurpose 1% of them. I'll be nice. But the 16,526 domestic employees at the Department of State, they had no way to tap into that human resource to make that go better? No, no,
yeah.
I don't accept it.
I think that they hammered it in point one, and everything else that happened to them after that. You know, when you say that we didn't know that this rapid decision was going to flow the way it did, I mean, that they were surprised. And surprise is never good to any agency in government. But to have it happen at the way it happened, you know, they're left, as you say, they're trying to shift the blame slightly to DOD, but DOD didn't know. You know, we were getting the announcement to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan without, as they said, sufficient senior level consideration of worst case scenarios and how quickly these might flow. That says it all. Somebody screwed the pooch and you know, they left a lot of people in a very bad place and trying to cover themselves as much as they can. I don't think they have to. They just have to hammer that number one point over and over and over. You know, we had insufficient planning and there was no worst case scenario planning. Boom.
And again, history hopefully won't be 50 years until they declassify the stuff, because I will not be here. History will show eventually what that decision-making process is, and I don't think it's going to look good on anybody. There's a lot of reckoning to be done. We'll revisit this topic when Jerry was here. I just think that that State Department report, and again, I give full credit to the State Department. They're the first out of the box. Bad on the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs that they haven't pushed out. I don't think they've pushed out anything. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I missed it, which is probably a bad thing, too, if they pushed something out and I haven't seen it yet and we haven't talked about it. But the State Department, they got their message out first, which was, when you look at it, internal politics. It was probably smart on their part.
Well, yeah, it's always, as you said, it's always good to be first. But they've laid the groundwork for other people to, if they haven't gotten their reports out yet, to go, you know, we'd like to note that, we didn't have any better information about what was going to happen. We had little chance to plan this the way it should. So I think it'll be interesting to see what they actually say. Or as this report becomes more widely known.
And I think there are a lot of people who, I think in the public space, not just on this issue, but on a lot of issues, and I think Congress is getting a little better on this. I haven't seen quite enough out of the think tank world for whatever reason. But I don't really care what your political persuasion is when it comes to foreign policy and the image of our nation, I don't think we can just defer to certain people simply because they are the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or the Director of the CIA or the Secretary of the Treasury or anything else, that when they through either, you know, acts of commission, omission, or, you know, intellectual failure, people need to call them out. And if it doesn't elicit change in those individuals, which it probably won't, at least will set some boundaries for whoever follows, if enough people will raise holy hell. Now, I remember back in the Obama administration, one of the things that gave me an eye twitch because, you know, you and I, as JOs, we kind of saw Asia from two different ends. You saw Asia from the international dateline to the coast of Vietnam. And when I was a young JO, I saw Asia through the lens of the Middle East, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Saudi Arabia, all that stuff. And one thing that's true, whether you're talking about the Southwest Asian culture or the East Asian culture, is image matters, actions matter. Where you are in the messages you send by not just what you do, but your body and what your conversation points are, it's critically important. And when, I don't know if you had a chance to see while you were enjoying the mountains, but there's a little bit of flashback to that time that, and again, I guess maybe we should fire all protocol officers or start hiring protocol officers with different backgrounds academically, our views. But you know, when President Obama bowed to the Saudi royals, that really was not sending the right message. And then we had over the weekend the Secretary of the Treasury yelling and the Chinese media is making hay out of it. I don't know if you had to see her multiple bows that she made to her counterpart who did not return the bow. It should have been made to begin with. Just
I did catch that.
Yeah,
at least she didn't get up. She didn't bow all the way to the floor. So
no, it was like bow, and he's extending his hand to shake his hand. I don't understand the damage that does to our image. In line of all the other things that are very real with the Chinese image. I just don't understand. And then we have the director of the CIA, who's, to his credit, has been as high profile as some recent ones, but he submitted a lecture. It's the Ditchley Foundation lecture in Oxfordshire, which evidently is a big thing. But I could not believe some of the things that I was reading, that this is what the priority of our CIA has, which again is something we've talked about here and I wrote about earlier this year, that the failures of the institutions, that people need to not be complacent about our institutions and who they are. You need to look at what they're saying and doing. But he, in this essay, I'm just going to quote him, quote, in 1992, this is when, to break from my quote for a second, this is when he worked at State. We see a recurring theme here. And he's worked for both parties because he was talking about how he worked for when Baker was Secretary of State. But he said, in 1992, I tried as best I could to sketch the shared global threats of climate change, insecurities, especially the raging HIV/AIDS epidemic. I spent much of the last two decades trying to understand and counter the combustible combination of grievance, ambition, and insecurity that Putin embodies. The climate crisis possesses today's most clear and present danger, unquote. That's the mindset in the background of the worldview of our CIA director. You and I were both around in 1992 in the immediate Cold War era. And without going into too much details, I'm fully briefed on HIV/AIDS since the mid-80s in a very personal way. And I don't understand why somebody at that much of a senior level could take two decades of trying to understand the combination of grievance, ambition, and insecurity that, you know, Putin has right now, when all you have to do is, going back to the beginning of the show, is read as much as you can to try to understand Russian history and just understand how human minds work. I remember the climate in 1992. It was hot then. It's hot now. I don't want to get into that. But it's just amazing at this point in time in the summer of 2023, with all the challenges that's beset, not just the United States, but its allies, and you have an opportunity to speak to your peers, and maybe that's why he wrote about what he did, that these are the topics the director of the CIA thinks he needs to be most invested in. And the world needs to be invested in thinking about. I would expect something like this from, the head of an NGO or maybe a member of Congress representing certain congressional districts with an academic background. But, people are relying on institutions and leaders to constantly do the right thing. You don't have to read history. You can just read what comes across the newswire in the last week.
Yeah, I think you could underestimate vastly, and it's too easy to do, vastly underestimate the influence of the "we're all going to die" climate change group in this particular administration. And, whether it's, I do a lot of reading in that area, and there are a lot of people out there questioning the amount of effort being put in to push this particular line, and but it is something, that is very strong, and people are being chosen for their positions who have never spoken out against, let's not make this the major focus of all our efforts, but the people who are saying this is the major focus of all our efforts, whether they're in defense or in the intelligence business or, you name the part of government, they're the ones who are getting promoted. And that is, I don't think that's a dirty secret anywhere. I just think that's the way it is. So if it is no longer a matter of not saying anything. It is a matter you have to be outspokenly in favor of these various things that have been rolled out especially during this administration, but which began in past administrations, so that, that these things are constantly in the forefront. Whether or not they are based in reality or science, that is a question which I think we need much more investigation on, and not just, some of the opinions that are expressed on the next time I see the word hockey stick, for example, I want to point people to a lot of other books which question the methodology of the hockey stick and the people behind it. So, it is a challenging problem, and we need to get a grip on it by more than just political people and people. I don't care if they're intelligent or not. They're not any better informed on it than a well-read public, and that is one more reason to be reading the counterarguments. You may not agree with the counterarguments. You may agree with this particular outlook that we're all going to there's immediate concern over this climate change, but there are other views, and they need to be looked at carefully, and we need to have, I think, a real national conversation about this that isn't driven by what I see essences of religious fervor, and rather than any real science behind it.
I think you're spot on. There is a religious nature to this, and in the show notes, I'll link to that lecture from Director Burns. And in it, I don't know whether it came across the microphone, I laughed when you said hockey sticks, because he, and one of the things, we talk about when you read biographies, when you read about leaders, when you read about, you're talking about books about certain commanding officers. One of the things that you see consistently is the important thing for a leader is to be calm. Regardless of what's happening around you, you have to be the most calm person on the bridge, on NCIC or on the firing line. You've got to be the calmest person there. And he was hyperbolic. And one of the points he says, and there's this, not just about climate, but he said, there's a whole series of hockey sticks out there. And you talk about don't really know too much. There's another comment that you'll appreciate as somebody who's been online as long as I have, if not longer, is he also says, he was talking about one of the things they're doing to counter Russian misinformation is to put videos online, like on Telegram and stuff. And he said, our first video had 2.5 million views in its first week. That's nothing. I mean, between Midrats, between my blog, your blog, our Twitter feeds, and just to be nice, we're already at 0.5 million. Let's roll in Sal Mercogliano, who just went over 100,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel. Let's throw him in there. The three of us could do 2.5 million views in a week. That's not a big deal. He doesn't understand the CIA director, the modern information space. That in itself was just gobsmacking to me. But, you know, that's where we are.
Well, the audience is telling us that we've gone silent.
Well, what
did you not pay for that? Did you not pay for that extra half hour?
I did pay for that extra half hour. Unfortunately, darn it! I just minimized what I needed here. Where are we? Here we go. We are, in theory, still recording. So, I must have done is instead of selecting 90 minutes, I selected 60 minutes live, but we are still recording. We have extra recording time. So this will be a podcast. So for those on the podcast, you're not missing anything. For those that are listening live, sorry about that. That's my fault. I made an error. I can't do anything right. I blame the heat. If you want...
It's the hockey stick.
The hockey stick got me. The State Department, I blame the DOD for me not selecting 90 minutes. I'll just work off that. One other thing about China, I know we both have a list of stuff. That's okay. If we can't get a guest for next week, we'll just pick up where we left off. But one thing I wanted to bring up, because as I was going down a Chinese rabbit hole, because one thing I was going to bring up, maybe we can talk about it next time, but the whole Belt and Road in China's Tom Shugart, also, for those that follow him on Twitter, retired Navy submariner captain. He's pretty good with the satellite pictures and stuff. But anyway, he noticed it as well, is that Chinese naval base that we talked about on previous shows in Cambodia has been expanded. And I just,
there is no Chinese naval base in Cambodia. It's a facility.
It's a facility. Exactly. Well, there was, as I was Googling it, this link came up that I knew this intrinsically, but I didn't have the hard numbers here. Now, we talk about Five Eyes, and some people want to make it Six Eyes by throwing Japan in there, but we talk about the Anglosphere. We say Five Eyes, it's the UK, the US, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And New Zealand is, my opinion of New Zealand is bifurcated, because they were there for us right after 9/11. They've been with us, including in Vietnam, almost every time. But they had an anti-nuclear policy that told us to beat feet, even though they still had at that time the occasional Echo 2 lurking off their coast they would expect us to go after. They've been a little problematic on the stage, and they've definitely been getting closer to the People's Republic of China. And here are the numbers that I found. In 2008, they signed a free trade agreement with the People's Republic of China. Since then, 2008 for me seems like yesterday, exports to China have increased eightfold, to the point that last year in 2022, China surpassed Australia as the largest export market. And that's reached the point with a lot of the economists, as the pressure is coming for everybody to decouple, like the Chinese designed. And again, you got to give full credit to the Chinese. They're very good at this. The New Zealand economy isn't diversified enough that they can decouple from the PRC right now. They are just so embedded, and their economy has adjusted so much, and the influence in Wellington from the People's Republic of China is so great that even though their defense and security experts and even some of their economists say they want to decouple, their political structure and a lot of their business interest can't slash won't. You know, there's a warning sign for everybody, like Germany and energy and Russia is the weak sister of the Five Eyes, though on occasion Canada's trying to compete with New Zealand. That economic tie-in that the PRC has done with one of the members of the Five Eyes, that I don't know if scary is too much of an alarmist word, but you know, what's the old cliche? Sometimes you exist in life simply to be an example to others of what not to do. That's impressive.
That is. And it's, well, New Zealand has always had a slightly more leftist bent than a lot of the, that's hard to say, since both Britain and Australia have dabbled that direction quite a bit. But, they, you know, they got into a trend later on of being more conservative, if you will, economically. But I don't know what they see in the world, but I guess as far as the way they are from everything else except Australia's Western Shore, and even that's pretty far away, they just have their own little spin on things.
Yep, and you know, in a way, you can talk yourself into that. They are blessed with geography, and all you got to do is look at the map and see what that looks like. But anyway, we have that rest of the list. I guess we'll just have to get to it next time.
That's the way it should work sometimes.
Okay. Well, hey, we'll catch you every time. And sorry to everybody who were with us live, and it died at the top of the hour, but you'll get it on the podcast. And for everybody else who is with the podcast, we appreciate you joining us for another edition of Midrats. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Read books.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.